Hello, this is Christopher Bolin. Once again, back with an audio file, my second audio file, on a beautiful Saturday afternoon. It's the 27th of October, and I have with me today Helya Kaskel.
Hello.
We're making an audio file for the benefit of my listeners and readers on my website, www.bolin.com. Helya, today we're going to talk about three subjects. We're going to start with discussion of letters and questions from readers, aren't we?
Right.
And then I'm going to have a second segment in which we discuss the USS Liberty, the Israeli attack on the USS Liberty ship in 1967 during the Six-Day War. It's been 40 years. And the some of the connections that exist between that military attack on the USS ship and the 9/11. And the last segment, we'll be talking about the 9/11 litigation and my article, The Planes of 9/11. And there's also some news we have to deal with from Popular Mechanics. There's an article that they're coming out with about, or some comments about debunking 9/11 and Benjamin Sheratov. So we'll start this segment by some of these letters. Helya, you've got some letters here that we've gotten at feedback. That's people write back at feedback@bolin.com. And the first letter you've given me here is, I'm going to read most of the letter. This says, "Hello, Christopher. I'm happy to know you are well." He wrote this on the 16th of October. "I'm so pleased that you sent the update to me. And I have no doubt, after carefully examining the sequence of events and professional and personal connections regarding Israeli operatives, that you are on to a significant key in the attacks of 9/11. The seemingly well-disguised pieces to the puzzle continue to come together. I have actually prayed for your safety and hope that your persistence hadn't faltered." It hasn't. "I have spent considerable effort in comprehending the loyalties and connections among key officials and their actions in the several hours before and immediately following the attacks. I am certain that weaknesses exist. More accurately, I'm convinced that there are people of conscience, unwitting dupes in the subversion of procedure that day, that are, as yet, unwilling to come forth. The criminals inside and outside of the U.S. government responsible for the attacks, either directly or indirectly, must be exposed if these United States are to begin the long road to recovery on a myriad of fronts. I have found that in my desire to affect the numbers in the consensus, a true knowledge of unsanitized U.S. foreign policy history, largely through ruthless black ops and CIA actions, is essential. Without this broad, stark record at the forefront of the patriot mindset, the dark, deeply disturbing realities of the 9/11 attacks will be missed. Peak oil, media subservience, the PNAC realities, unconscionable elitism and corporatism built into the U.S. political mechanisms are powerful factors. Governing through hope has given way to ruling through fear, and I refuse to take my place among the bewildered herd. Should these supremely arrogant persons go unpunished, can you imagine the future high-ranking U.S. officials that will one day be emboldened to perpetrate yet unimaginable horrors in quest of empire? It's hard for me to accept the possibility of simply surviving Bush, Cheney, and cohorts. We and the growing number of determined, like-minded malcontents need desperately to demonstrate for all that they cannot escape their crimes. My long-held respect for my country has evolved into a genuine fear of my government. I am deeply concerned for my children and, frankly, alarmed for my grandchildren." And he finishes by saying, "Please, sir, be safe. Keep your family close and never, ever be deterred in your profoundly important mission. You are among the best, and I believe that you are at the vanguard of a breakthrough." I got that letter on the 16th of October from a supporter. And it's through support of people like him that I'm able to do these shows, and actually that I'm able to continue doing my research. So many thanks to him and people like him. But he brings up in his letter a very important point, and that is the fear. He talks about the fear that the Americans had become a country that was governed through hope and optimism to becoming a nation that has given way to ruling through fear. And I noticed that before, when I was in my trial, when I was corresponding with a lot of people, that Americans more and more are living in fear. Well, did you notice that, Helia?
Yes. We've noticed that people don't dare to write the return addresses to their letters anymore. They're afraid to, you know, use telephones.
They're afraid their email is being read. They're afraid that their phones are being listened to.
They're even afraid on the streets. They're afraid of the next car driving after them. It's just amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
But people, regular people who are not involved in political arena publicly as you are, that they should have so much fear in their everyday life. This is something I can just imagine what happened during the Stalin time in the Soviet Union. But the same kind of zeitgeist has arrived in America. This is very discouraging.
And the question is, what are they actually afraid of? Who and what are they afraid of?
Well, this is this invisible monster they're afraid of. But, you know.
But why should Americans be afraid? Are they afraid of other Americans? Are they afraid of their own government?
Afraid of their own government, and we've seen from our own experience how you should be afraid of your own or your own police.
Right.
If they have given permission to drive around without uniforms, just disguised, right. You know, they are like hunting for trouble. They are trying to find people make mistakes, and if that doesn't happen, then they criminalize just innocent people.
Right. That's a very good point. Before I go to the next letter, the three men that attacked me at my house, when they came to my house, they were not wearing uniforms and they didn't present any badges or identification.
They came in an unmarked car.
Right. But what's interesting is that in the court procedures that followed, when the three men were in court, only one of them actually has a uniform. Officers Stoy and Felgenhauer, who are on this tactical paramilitary type team, actually don't have police uniforms.
Right.
The only one that had a police uniform is Officer Barber, Michael Barber. I find that very odd that officers in a small community would have no uniforms.
Another thing is that on internet there are circulating some information as if those three were regular traffic cops. If they are regular traffic cops, then why aren't they wearing any uniforms? And as we heard during the court procedures, you know, they have a long military experience.
Right.
Why don't you tell us about that a little bit? You know, these guys were ready for a fight.
Right. Well, that was pretty clear. We know that Officer Barber was a military police for 6 years, and during that period, he dealt with prisoners. I think that was in the early 90s, time of the first Gulf War, from 90 to 96 or something. And we know that Felgenhauer had a 10-year military career in which he was also doing military police activity. And, you know, it's a great source of concern. I remember at the Axis for Peace conference in Brussels that the general from India raised the question of what will happen to these 160,000 American vets when they return from Iraq after being through this intense trauma, and then they try to reintegrate into normal life in America. Many of them will probably wind up being police as well, and that's a real source of concern. I want to go to the next letter, though. This is another letter came in on the 26th of October, it looks like, and this person writes, and then reading that an Israeli company is responsible for security at many or most U.S. military bases, as well as at progressively more U.S. water supply companies, makes me wonder where the corruption hasn't spread. Too many people are just too unsuspecting and have allowed themselves to be led into such a dangerous situation. He says, I suppose that's why they're considered cattle. The problem about persuading people of the truth is that it's so bizarre, so far from the benign reality that people are used to believing. He says David Ray Griffin has a good bit at the beginning of debunking, discussing why people resist facing the truth, wishful and fearful thinking. Yep, that's true. And the thing is that the media reality, the reality that people have accepted, like the, I know these people at Popular Mechanics called the 9/11 version, the popularly accepted version. I think that's very interesting. It's the media version. And the reality, or what the facts indicate, what the evidence indicates, is so unlike what they've been told that there's this, what do they call that, cognitive dissonance or whatever, where there's just no way they can connect the two in their head. So it is very fearful. You handed me this letter. This is a letter from a supporter of from Switzerland. And he writes back about my article, Planes in 911. It's the first article in the Solving 9/11 series. He wrote, thank you very much for this article, for the chapter one. Very impressive, he says. There must be a complete exposure of this network of murderers and liars, given the corruption in high places, a very grave challenge indeed. It would require insiders to come out and talk. I shudder to contemplate what might happen if such a thorough cleansing would actually be demanded by the people. How can your work be used to trigger decisive action? He asks. We live in a world where terrorists and liars are honored with the Nobel Peace Prize, and very few object. That's a very good point that he makes there. One of the key people that is involved in the Israeli crimes of the last 50 years, 40 years, is Shimon Peres, who's currently the president of Israel. And he has been a member of the Israeli government since the late 50s, and he's been in practically every government position. He got the Nobel Peace Prize, and he's a very dangerous man. Even other Israeli leaders, like Moshe Sheret, warned the Israelis that if Shimon Peres ever got into power, it would be a disaster. Let's see, we have another short bit here. This is a letter from a supporter in Chicago, and he wrote, while we don't know each other, I have been following your pursuits and challenges. I, too, am asking myself and others, in light of all the crimes, all the lies, what do we stand for? What does it mean to be American? This used to be a very easy question, and now something I can't express. He says, thanks, Chris, and please don't stop your plight. Don't stop your plight. Don't stop my fight, that's for sure. Okay. And there's one more here. You want to show me something here? There's this letter here. I appreciate your work. This came from a supporter and wish to support you so you can produce more work of this quality. This is a person writing about the Hellerstein case.
Here's somebody thanking you. Thank you for sending me your most recent article, and thank you, too, for the audio podcast that accompanied it. The audio was a perfect companion to the research you provided, and I would very much appreciate more of the same if you consider to do so in the future.
Right.
So
that's why we're doing this, because a lot of people in America don't have time to read. But they do have time to listen to audio casts, maybe when they're driving their car.
Yeah.
Or when they have time.
They
like
download it on their CDs and right. Listen to them when they drive. Here's another letter. I really find your work very informative. Never stop exposing the real axis of evil. Yes, I can see through the lies, and I believe anyone who has met you personally can see through it as well. And I'm sure this part means this defamation, which has been going on online, because this letter comes from a supporter we have met in Chicago.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me finish with this one letter here I have from a British reader. And he writes and he says, the world has become a very different place to that of the illusions of my preceding 60 years or so. I am no longer proud to be British. Rather, I'm ashamed. America is no longer the land of the free, but rather fast approaching police state status. The West in general are not the good guys, but rather a cynical, grasping, amoral collection of states determined to maintain effective control of the world's economic systems and the distribution of what's left of its natural resources, particularly oil, which is pretty much the raison d'etre of our entire Middle Eastern meddling, at whatever cost. And God help anyone who stands in their way. Well, that's well said. The oil in the Middle East and in Iraq and the record profits of the oil companies certainly indicate that that was certainly one of the reasons for the war in Iraq. Well, that's been the first segment. We're going to have some questions in the second section that we'll address. Some people have asked some questions of me. So we'll take a break now, and we'll be back with some questions in the next section. Okay, thank you.
We took the long way home, held my hand. The day's so full, all the things we had planned. We walked beyond the green, beyond the day. We shared a dream, then I let slip away. I had to find myself,
find myself.
I had to find myself. Looking for no one, love you till I find myself.
Hello again, it's Christopher Bolin. It's Saturday afternoon, October 27th, and this is the an audio file that we're putting together, the second audio file for Bolin.com. In this section, we're going to deal with some questions. Helia has some questions from email that people have sent to feedback at bolin.com.
Yes.
Okay, let's have some questions in.
Here, a lady sends an email from New York. She's a lawyer. And now and then people still comment on your court case. And here this lady says that, unlike you, I do not find the police action against you heavy-handed or unusual. So, obviously, this lawyer is not well acquainted with all the facts of what happened to us.
Well, she says she doesn't find it unusual.
Right.
First of all, I saw that mail, and she doesn't seem to be very well versed on the facts of the case. So the best go to Bolin.com.
Yes.
And you can read about where is that information?
On the home page, on the very first page, there are these articles which Dr. Linda Shelton wrote as she was the independent court observer.
Right.
She's very clever in law, and she's the member of Chicago Pro Se
Club.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. They were very helpful. The Pro Se people were very helpful. With my case, but there's on Rumor Mill News, that's rumormillnews.com, I posted a lot of the evidence that I discovered. I began investigating what happened to me and that arrest about a couple months after it happened, when I realized that my lawyer at the time wasn't on my side.
It unfortunately took us several months. I mean, this incident happened in August, and by January, our lawyer hadn't done any discovery. And we thought, oh, yeah, we have a lawyer. We've paid him thousands of dollars, you know, sure, he will do something.
Mm-hmm.
And since we had never been any experience in such a situation before, mm-hmm. we just totally wasted lots of precious time.
Mm-hmm.
The lawyer was just dallying, waiting until all the time limits went by,
yeah.
you know. So
that was Jack
if you
Smeaton.
Hadn't done all your right. own Freedom of Information
Act,
then we wouldn't have gotten the
right.
discovery we did.
Right. Well, what she's getting at is that I learned a lot from this case about how the American court process works, and I've learned how it is quite corrupt. Even in a small case like mine, a seemingly small case, there's corruption throughout, that the defense lawyers are often working with the prosecutor and with the judge, you know, serving you up. What is that expression that Roland Huntford uses? Is that he says the defense lawyers are often working to serve the client up to the jaws of justice.
The gaping jaws of justice.
Yeah, well, that's certainly what was happening to me.
And even with the second lawyer we had, everything seemed to be understood. But you cannot guarantee what your lawyer is going to say in the court.
Precisely.
You think that, oh, he's going to say that now. Oh, he's going to react to this.
Precisely.
No. They just won't even roll over when the most blatant lies have been, you know, presented to the jury.
But let's get back to this. She says it wasn't. She doesn't think it was unusual. Well, it was unusual. What I found out was that the police actually had prepared to commit violence against me before they even got to my house.
Right.
I had called 911 about the suspicious car with three men, armed men wearing body armor, and those men had about half an hour to prepare to set up their attack.
Because you were not at home
right.
while you made the phone call.
Right. And so I told, you know, it wasn't an emergency. I said, well, send an officer to my house and we'll talk about what's this car.
Many people wonder, why did you have to take a bike? Why didn't you ride a car to the store? The thing is that we had just arrived from Europe,
yeah,
from a trip. We had been at home for 10 days. And for the fact, the whole family rides bikes. We live in an area where you actually don't even need a car.
It was August of 2006. We'd been out west. We'd been in the West Coast. We'd been in North Dakota. And we'd been home.
But that was just like a continuation to
yeah.
a trip which
yeah.
we had started making the year before in September.
Right. But the thing is that it is very unusual that the police had conspired and planned, and actually the 9/11 operator had heard that there was an unknown medical emergency.
Yes.
The deputy fire chief told me that there was a fight in progress. So they were alarmed that there was violence either occurring or going to occur, or there was a medical emergency. Yet this was before anybody had arrived at my house.
Yeah, in the transcript, they repeated three times, pre-prepared for an unknown medical emergency.
Right.
Medical problem.
Yeah.
Unknown medical problem. And this happens before the cops even arrive. And since we live so close to the fire department, then the fire department arrived at the same time with the cops.
Yeah, as the unidentified.
But, of course, we didn't know at that time that they were cops. They were just unidentified
right.
men, three men marching up your driveway.
Right.
Who do you think they are?
And now within one minute of their arrival and meeting me, they had me on the ground, handcuffed and tasered.
It's interesting also that the version of events which was presented in the court was totally different from what really happened, because when these three identified men came, they first met me and my daughter
mm-hmm.
while in the court. They totally had wiped that aside
right.
and they made it look as if Christopher met them first, came out from the house yelling and whatnot, while this happened somewhat later.
Now, wait, let's get back to this point. She says she doesn't find it unusual. Now, this is interesting because this was the reason for my phone call in the first place, is that I have lived in that town all my life. The fire station, the police station used to be a block from my house. I'm intimately aware of the development of that town. And when I saw this car with three men wearing body armor, driving around like I said, like the streets of Baghdad, like these contractors in Iraq, I thought that was very unusual.
Right.
And when I saw it for the second day driving around my house, you know, apparently prowling in my neighborhood.
Also, the window was open. They were like looking out of the window. One arm was out of the window looking at a house as if they were looking for something.
But when they drove by my house the second day, like you said, you know, on a 20-mile-an-hour street, driving about 15 miles an hour, looking out at my house and me and the kids in the yard, that's unusual. And if Americans don't find that unusual, then we certainly are in a very different America. But let's go on to the second question this lady has. She has another question here. What is that?
Yes. She says that, "I am disturbed that you had not divulged anything your past residence in Israel, living on a kibbutz and married to an Israeli, and your interest in learning to speak Hebrew."
Okay.
Well,
I can look, that's very simple. I've been a journalist since June of 2000 with the Spotlight and American Free Press. That was when I began working professionally as a journalist. Prior to that, I worked for IBM, Global Network Services. But this question about Israel. Now, I actually began my journalism career at the University of California in Santa Cruz. I studied journalism. I studied the Middle East. And during the Second Intifada, I think it was in 1991, after the first Gulf War, I was studying journalism, and I took three photographers all together. We went to the West Bank, and I did a month-long in-depth research article and photographic essays. Now, what I'm getting at is that I have never hidden that, my experience in the Middle East. In fact, when I started working for American Free Press, Willis Cardo and Mike Piper were very enthused that I had all this experience in the Middle East. I went to the Middle East the first time in 1975 after I finished high school. I'd been in Iran and Turkey, Syria, Jordan.
Some people don't understand what business did you have to go there.
Oh, well.
But they don't understand that you actually resided in Europe and you just made trips from where you lived.
Well, no, that came later. This was when I was 18 years old. I just finished high school and I had Wanderlust. I wanted to see the world. And in those days, in the mid-70s, it was still possible to travel across Asia to India and to Afghanistan. And it was, it was the route that the people like Led Zeppelin sang about and things like that. It was quite an adventure. And I was on my way to Afghanistan, actually, when it was wintertime. And somebody at the hotel in Tehran told me that you could pick oranges in Israel. And I thought that sounded like a pretty good thing to do because the snow was deep. It was very cold in Iran and even colder in Afghanistan. So, and I had very little money. And so I turned around and went back to Turkey and down through Syria. And I had grown up, I was raised as an Episcopalian, an Anglican, a Christian. And my only understanding of the Middle East had come from reading the Chicago newspapers. Mm-hmm. And what I learned in school and what I learned in church. And I know Jericho and Bethlehem and Jerusalem from growing up in the church. And for me, it was the Holy Land. And it was very interesting. But I went there in the winter of 1975. It was very cold. I came across the bridge from, it was after Christmas. I came across the bridge from Jordan, Jesser Hussein, Allenby Bridge. And the first place you come is the little town of Jericho. And I remember I was hitchhiking and walking up that road up the Jordan Valley. And the first place I came to was the old refugee camp. It's a ghost town. It's a huge, huge sprawling area of these clay brick huts, all abandoned. And you can tell that a very large population once lived there. Has been removed. And that was the first thing I saw. And because I had so much experience in the Arab countries, I'd spent time in Syria and Jordan and Iran, not an Arab country, of course, but I had been treated very well. The hospitality of the Syrian people, I'd never seen anything like that in my life. So although I came to Israel in the first time in 1975, and the Israelis, of course, had a very bad history in 73 with the war, the Yom Kippur War with the Syrians, I told them, I said, but the Syrians were very nice people, the people that I met. I thought there was a very nice people. But that was the beginning of my experience with Israel and Zionism, and I wound up going to this kibbutz near the Sea of Galilee. It was called Afikim. It's one of the original kibbutzim. You know, the Sea of Galilee in the Jordan Valley has about a dozen old kibbutzim, Deganya Aleph, Deganya Bet, Engev, Afikim. These are kibbutzim that were started by these Russian immigrants back in the turn of the century, 1900 time period. And I learned what Zionism was from Israelis. More to the point, I learned from original Zionist pioneers, people who came to Palestine in the 1920s, the 1930s, dedicated to this Zionist cause. I would find it very hard to understand Zionism or to write about Zionism had I not had years of experience living in Israel.
Firsthand. Yes.
I used to be a lifeguard, for example, in the Jordan Valley, and my boss was some old Lithuanian Jew who had come as a young man to Palestine.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, by learning the Hebrew language, my Hebrew isn't very good, but by learning it and by learning Arabic and spending so much time in the West Bank and riding my bicycle and traveling through Gaza and the Sinai, that's how I understand the Middle East. I mean, how I understand Israel's role in the Middle East. And when I came back to the United States, I learned that the level of discourse in the United States, in the media, was absolutely abysmal. The American people were being kept in the dark about Zionist history, a history that I had seen, that I had experienced. And they were the facts of Israel and the history of Israel the American people had not been informed of that. And in the next segment, we'll talk a little bit about the attack on the USS Liberty and how that fits into the research and what I'm working on in the 9/11 attack. So thank you very much, and stay tuned for the next segment.
You were the man who knew too much to say. So many things that I learned came your way. These things I know that I can't forget. Deep in my heart, they're a part of me, yeah. Help me find myself.
Find myself.
Help me find myself.
Find myself.
No use looking for no one else. I'll be lonely till I find myself.
Hello again. It's Christopher Bolin. It's a nice Saturday afternoon, and it's the 27th of October. This is the second audio file that I'm doing, and it's I'm here with Helya Kaskel, my wife.
Hello.
And we've talked about some comments and questions that readers have sent us to feedback@bolin.com. And thanks to the generous support of people who read my material, who have sent via PayPal to bolin@bolinbooks.com or shop@bolinbooks.com, I'm able to do this audio file. This is the third section, and I answer some questions about, you know, people asking about my role in my experience in Israel. The thing is that I've been to Israel, I can't count how many times, because from the first time in the winter of 1975, I think I stayed there about 6 months or more. I stayed there the whole summer because I became a lifeguard, so I stayed there about 7, 8 months. And then I would go back to Europe. And in Europe, I wound up living in Norway with a very erudite and interesting Swedish woman, an older Swedish woman who was a countess. When I first went there, I think she was about 67 years old. And she needed somebody to help take care of this big house in Oslo near Holmenkollen. And her maid had been in a car accident. And so I wound up through connections I had with journalists who had been in the Middle East, most notably Anders Sandvig. Through him, I came in contact with Fru Tresco, Elizabeth Tresco, and lived there for several winters. And there I studied academically the Middle East. I studied Egyptian at the University of Oslo. I studied Biblical Hebrew, and I read a lot of from her Judaica. And
You say that you have studied many languages in your life, like 15 languages.
Yeah. I mean, at the same time that I was living in Norway, of course, I studied Norwegian.
And while you travel, you always try to pick up some of the local language. So for people to think that if somebody speaks two or three languages fluently, that's a clear indication that you must be an agent. So, like, I come from a small country, Estonia, where there are only 1,000 people, 1 million people who speak my language. So I have to be able to express myself in English and Swedish, maybe, or German, other languages, because try to learn something in Estonian. It's not an easy trip.
Exactly. Exactly. And, you know, I was interested in languages. One of my great grandfather was a Norwegian minister in North Dakota, and I looked at his what he studied in college and seminary, is that he studied languages, mm-hmm. and that's all he studied virtually in these schools in Iowa and Minnesota, and he was a preacher in German, in Swedish, in Norwegian,
and Latin,
and he read and spoke Latin. It was amazing, you know. Languages are very important. So that's to address this. I've been to Israel many times, and the last time I've been to Israel, if I recall correctly, was 1992.
No, it was in 1990. It was before we met.
1991, then it was. It was during the Intifada. It was after the Gulf War, which ended in 1991, January. So it was after that. It was the spring of 1991. That's when I took this journalism trip, and I took these photographers from University of California, Santa Cruz. And we went through the West Bank, and we went to places like the Kasbah of Nablus, and went around with the Palestinian guys. And I remember we were walking through the Kasbah, and we heard some shooting. And Palestinians, being always extremely polite, he told us, and now we start running. So it was a very interesting experience. It was a real eye-opener for my friends who I brought there. But I'd covered the Intifada before. I'd been to Gaza. And the one thing that I've learned from the Israel and the Middle East is that the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is the core conflict. But it cannot be, if you're opposed to it, if you challenge it, it's not the place to do it in Israel, because you will wind up like Rachel Corrie. They will bulldoze you over, or they will kill you, or they will shoot you. And I have had friends of mine who have been shot. I don't want that to happen to me. But furthermore, to be more effective, the United States is the key sponsor and supporter of the State of Israel. This is why the American people are kept in the dark about Israel and the history of Zionism. Because if they knew the criminal nature of the enterprise that they are supporting, they would question supporting it. But we'll get into that in the next segment. And we're going to discuss the attack on the USS Liberty. And is there any more questions there that you wanted to raise? No, I don't think so. That's all the questions? Okay, well, thank you very much. That's the questions and comments section. And we'll be back in the next segment. We'll be discussing the Israeli military attack on the USS Liberty in 1967. And what that means and the similarities to the 9/11 attack at the World Trade Center and the Pentagon. So thank you very much, and stay tuned for the next segment.
Too many years rolled by without a word. I try to hide behind things that I'd heard. And now the truth is clear for all to see, that through it all, it was you believed in me. You helped me find myself. I'll be lonely till I find myself. I gotta find myself.
Find myself.
I gotta find myself.
Find myself.
No use looking for no one else. I'll be lonely till I find myself.